This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. J.R. Gorham says his upbringing in the small farming community of Falkland, North Carolina, was full of hard lessons, and his sharecropper father was the one who did much of the teaching. It was a tough love approach that didn't leave room for self-pity or excuses. But for J.R., it turned out to be exactly what he needed. He went on to become the first black brigadier general in the North Carolina National Guard and vice president of Kernersville branch of First Citizens Bank. To remember his father's lessons and legacy, he also became an author. He wrote a book called Sharecropper's Wisdom, and J.R. Gorham joins me in the studio now. General Gorham, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank. It's great to be here today.
Tell us more about Falkland, North Carolina.
Well, it's a little small town in eastern North Carolina, about 10 miles from Greenville, which is the county seat. Yeah. I tell folks all the time the population there is 117. 116 now that I live in Kernersville, North Carolina. But it's a very loving community. Everybody knew everybody, and everybody kind of looked out for everybody. But it was kind of tough growing up in the 60s and 70s in Falkland.
Farming the main business, right?
Right, being the son of a sharecropper, yeah. There was not a lot of resources there, so there was not much to do as far as the social side of things, but we managed along okay, and we all grew up just fine.
Father keep you pretty busy on the farm?
All the time. Yeah. I mean, from sunup to sundown, he was a hard taskmaster, and that's one of the main reasons why I joined the Army. I joined it for two reasons. One, to get away from my daddy, and the other one was to get away from that tobacco field.
and you talked about the community. I mean, everybody was out there sharing in the work, too, right?
Yes. I mean, that was the thing that everybody did. Our neighbors were sharecroppers. Everyone in our church basically was sharecroppers. Mm-hmm. And then we, you know, helped each other out during times, during hard times. The family up the street from us, when we went to school, we came home from school, took off our school clothes, and went to the pack house to tie tobacco. One night we would be at our tobacco pack house, and the next night we would be in the neighbors up the street pack house. All the families coming together to help prepare the tobacco for market. So it was a really close-knit community, and they didn't take much to a lot of foolishness.
Didn't seem like there's much time for it. Were you, I mean, at the time, were you thinking about how do I get out of here? I mean, talk about what you're thinking as a young man having to do all this.
Yes, that was one of the things, another thing that caused me to join the United States Army. I wanted to try to figure out how could I lift myself from this life of basic poverty, and how could I possibly negotiate this maze called life with few resources. So I wanted a college education, and at that time, it was at the end of the Vietnam War. There were benefits for young people who would join the military. They could, if you join in for 2 to 3 years, once you got out, you could take advantage of the GI Bill and go to school. And so that's what I did. I joined the Army. I tell folks, one day I was barefooted, priming tobacco in my daddy's tobacco field, and the next day I was at Fort Jackson, South Carolina. I had some boots on my feet. I slept in air conditioning for the very first time in my life, and I could drink all the milk I wanted. I was in hog heaven, so I used my benefits then to come back to go to East Carolina University.
Well, and from the sound of it and from reading your book, and you love your father deeply, but it might be that Army life and those barracks might have been easy on you in terms of the amount of work, and even the level of abuse that you would have taken would have been less in the military than with your own dad.
Oh, yes. When I went into the military, it was like a step up. I mean, it's the best I'd ever lived. So it was a good experience for me, and I was used to following orders because, you know, if my father had to tell me to do something twice, there was a licking coming behind that.
Well, and he also instructed you in the ways, because this was, again, at a time of, if not, if legal segregation had ended, and I think you were talking about being, you know, living through the bridge
right.
Over that time.
Yes.
Your father taught you the hard way how to pay attention to those rules, right?
Yeah, he understood the social norms of that time where, being a young person, I didn't. And I recall one event where we had finished picking cucumbers, and he took it to Oscar Snack's bar there in Falkland. And the social norm of the day was that the whites sat to the front of the grill, and there was a bar at the back where African Americans were served. So we went in to get an ice cream cone, and some gentlemen stopped my father, and they engaged in a conversation, and I was tired and hot. So I decided that I would sit down in one of those chairs at the front of the store. And as soon as my bottom touched that chair, my daddy snatched me up, and he said, "Boy, don't you ever sit in those seats again. Your place is back at the bar." He didn't do that as a to degrade me or anything. He did it as a form of protecting his child, because he understood the norms and I did not. And so that was a tough lesson to learn, and I never forgot that. And all during my adolescence and even to my early adulthood, I was trying to find my place, because I didn't think it should be at the back of the bar, of the store.
Tell me what you make of that then, and we'll talk about, you know, moving forward to where you are now. But again, you understand now that this is about survival to your father. So we'll talk about social progress some other time, but right now you're in danger. You understand that now. But but this is also about a degrading situation that should not be. It's wrong. And where were you in that moment?
Well, first of all, I didn't understand it. But secondly, I was determined, that I was going to try the best I could to get to a point where, in my eyes and in my thoughts, that I qualified to be able to sit at the front of the store, not at the back. And so I kind of made that my life mission to better myself, to try to make something of myself, but more importantly, to make my father proud of me.
But that means you also understood at a certain level, and I'll put words in my mouth, so please correct me if I'm wrong, that you would have understood at a certain level that you as a black man would have to work harder, and that's going to be the rule of America. That if you're African American, you're on an unlevel playing field, and you will have to work harder.
Absolutely. And I also understood that, you know, even though you work hard, sometimes you don't get the proper recognition that we think that we deserve. When you see other folks moving along and you don't seem to same effort for them that you're putting forth, but you're not getting recognized for it, it is sometimes very disheartening. And every time I would find myself in those types of situations, I would hear my father's voice. "Boy, when you get to the end of your rope, you tie a knot and you hang on. Don't quit, because it will eventually change." And his words was some of the things that kept me on the right path, because of what he shared with me in that old raggedy smoking Silverado pickup truck that I was so ashamed of then, but I'm so proud of now.
Yeah, talk about that. You were, and it wasn't so bad in the lower grades in elementary school when you were in your community, but then when you moved out.
Yeah, when you got into high school, you know, then those types of things made a difference. And at that particular time, because I did not understand, I was ashamed of the environment in which I was raised in. And so going to high school, as a freshman, I became vice president of the school. And that was partly because my youngest sister was a superstar basketball player. Name recognition meant a lot, and still does, you know. And so I became the vice president of the school my freshman year. And, you know, friends would ask, "Hey, you want to come spend the weekend with me?" And I would always turn them down and say no, because I knew that if I went and spent the weekend with them, eventually they was going to want to come spend the weekend with me. And I was did not want anybody to know the conditions in which I was living in at that particular time. Did not know that the true riches, you know, I had them. I didn't have the material riches of life, but the things that really counted, two caring parents who loved us dearly and taught us right from wrong, those morals that they taught us served us well as we went forth, especially myself in the military.
Talking to General J.R. Gorham, who's written the book, Sharecropper's Wisdom, Growing Today's Leaders the Old-Fashioned Way. Well, you did join the military, and you talked about having to continually face these obstacles and situations where you were having to work harder than others, and it happened to you as you advanced through the military, right?
Yes, it was constantly being a challenge. I always excelled from the time I started in basic training. I got promoted out of basic training. Then when I went to OCS, I was the Distinguished Honor Graduate of my OCS class. And then when I got out into the field, so to speak, and started moving up, everything seemed to go well until I reached field grade, the rank of major. And I recall one incident where I was the plans officer for the 30th Infantry Brigade, and I was a major. My assistant was a captain, and he was Caucasian. I was black. I worked real hard for like 3 years, getting awards every summer for annual training for outstanding performance. And then I recall one Sunday we had a commander's conference, and the battalion commander of the battalion, which I was trying to go to be his operations officer, he came in and he announced to the whole group that the captain was getting the job, not me. I was livid. I was so mad that if I had blinked my eyes, tears would have came down my face. And so finally they gave us a break, and I went to the latrine of the bathroom and squared myself away, came out, and there was a few guys who knew what I was trying to do, and they was kind of congregated together, and they were standing there going like, "Gorham, what happened? What's going on with that?" And so what I did, I fronted. I go like, "Oh, I didn't want that job, no way, forget it, ain't no big a deal." But from Clinton to Winston-Salem, I was boiling, and I wanted to quit. But like I said, I would hear my father's voice, and I didn't. So then we fast forward, and I'm promoted to general. My number on the seniority roster was 44. I mean, I became a general. My number was 8. So I jumped over quite a few people to get promoted to general. And then I understood why I went through what I went through as a major, because I knew how those folks from 43 to 8 felt, because they was feeling the same way I felt. But you know, when you're the only African American in the room, and you see someone, you know, that's in your eyes, you know, a lower rank and didn't have the skill set that you did to get the promotion, that's a hard pill to swallow. But sometimes you just have to do that until your time comes.
When you got promoted to general, I understand that that made you the first African-American to be promoted to that rank in the State National Guard.
Yes, sir.
Given all that you've said about your dedication to your father and wanting to prove yourself to yourself and to your father personally, but also these ideas about racial injustice, I wonder what part of that is going through your mind when you ascend to that rank and you mark this first.
Oh, wow. That was I saw that as a awesome responsibility. Being the first, being a trailblazer, I wanted to make sure that I conducted myself in such a way that there would be no negative things or thoughts associated with me and my time in that rank, because I knew that, you know, folks would view me, you know, with like a magnifying glass, because I'm the first. And I didn't want to give anybody any ammunition to deny another African-American an opportunity to serve in that capacity. So I was very deliberate in the things that I did, the way I carried myself and operated, because I wanted to have when my name was mentioned, I wanted to be nothing but positive things associated with it. And so I'm thinking that based on how I left the organization, that I fulfilled that mission.
You have left, and you're retired, and then you also became vice president of the bank, the Kernersville Bank.
Yes. Well, I did at the same time I was in the military. Right. I was pursuing two careers at the same time.
And what are you doing now?
I'm a motivational speaker. I go out and I speak, and I talk about my book and promote it, and I try to give back. You are a little barefooted, curly-headed boy, prime of the back, and your daddy the back of field, and you rise up through the rank to become the first African-American general. You don't do that by yourself. There's a lot of people that had helped you along the way. And so I feel it incumbent upon me now to try to go out and help other people to do what I did. I try to share my life story with them and try to help them see that, hey, if you put forth the hard work and you don't quit, you can do likewise. So I speak to a lot of civic groups, a lot of youth groups. just try to share with them.
Well, I'm listening to everything you say now about the personal achievement and also your recognition that it took a whole community behind you and that you want to be part of that community going forward. But
yes.
And that you endured all this thinking, well, if I can just make an example, then it's going to be, there'll be fewer barriers for people.
Right.
I wonder if you think it's getting that way, given, you know, anybody who's been, lived through the civil rights movement of the 60s to today,
right.
feels a bit of backsliding. So many people had done that decades ago, and yet here we are still having to do that.
Yeah, we still
today.
Have the ebbs and flows in life, you know. There's some ups and there's some downs, you know, and you have to kind of go with the flow. Sometimes it seems like for every step you take forward, you're taking two steps back. And we're in a very challenging time right now. It seems like, you know, our country is probably more divided than I've seen it probably since the 60s. When I was just a little guy. And so it seems like we go around in cycles. And we're kind of like having some of those same challenges that I recall we were having when I was a younger fella. And now I'm kind of, as I say, when you get to that point where you realize you're closer to the exit than you are to the entrance, that's where I find myself.
What was it like for you to write this book?
Oh, it was a, it's like therapy to some degree, you know. It caused me to go back and think about things I hadn't thought about in many years. And but finally, I got through it. There was a lot of doubt in my mind, you know. Who wants to read a book about a sharecropper, you know? But my third oldest sister, Sarah, when she read the manuscript strip, she made it all work come together. And she read the book overnight and called me the next day. And she said, bruh, that's what they called me back home. Daddy would have never thought in a million years that somebody would have thought enough about his life as a sharecropper to write a book about him.
The man who did it was J.R. Gorham, the first Brigadier General in the North Carolina National Guard, first African-American, and a former vice president of First Citizens Bank in Kernersville. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Frank. Appreciate it.
The title of the book is Sharecropper's Wisdom. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. This is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, which is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.